I'm Christopher Lydon. Catching up with a wave of misgivings about this digital information revolution with the Princeton theorist Thomas Levine, who surveils media a lot like the cameras and cookies and cell phone records that never blink in their surveillance of us. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. Back in James Dudarian's classroom on global media this time, we're trying to get a snapshot, in effect, and perspective on the digital transformation of everything. I want to leap right into the question that you've written a lot about, Tom Levine, on surveillance. Orwell's 1984, without protest, suddenly we're there. Bob Herbert writes in the New York Times the other day about 3 million sort of stop and frisk identifications in New York City over the last 5 years, creating an unimaginably huge database of everybody and everything, every move that might be interesting someday. Where are we? What's happening here? How did it get so far without our sort of noticing, much less protesting?
In January 1984, there was a really interesting moment in the halftime of the Super Bowl when a commercial came on, which was shown only once, a commercial shot by Ridley Scott, which featured a kind of explicit Orwellian theme. It was about a group of drones looking at a screen and being completely mesmerized and passive. And suddenly in comes a voluptuous hammer-twirling woman chased by a group of bad guys and throws the hammer onto the screen, Big Blue, Big Brother, and the voiceover announces, in 1984, we are about to release a new computer called the Macintosh, and you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984. Here you have, in the commercial that opened the platform wars with the announcement of the Apple Macintosh, the old figure of 1984 as Big Brother. And it's the figure which, I think you're absolutely right, in a certain sense, is already then an anachronism, right? You can use it for a commercial. And it's, the shift, I think, is perhaps best captured by a sign on a Kenneth Cole store in Manhattan, where I live, a few years ago, which said, on any given day, you'll be captured by surveillance cameras 29 times. Are you dressed for it? Now, this moment, what one could call a kind of surveillant narcissism, already depicts an entirely different relation to these surveillance cameras. Far from being marked by anxiety, this is about surveillance as a platform for quotidian fabulousness. Surveillance as, or what a friend of mine called happy valence, as an opportunity to let the world see you, see me, and happily so. It's precisely what's at stake in the completely irresponsible non-attention to privacy settings in Facebook, which has finally become a topic, but, you know, of course, belatedly so. Increasingly, and this is what really marks a generational difference, the questions that seem to be central to any relationship to surveillance, I want to guard my privacy, don't seem to be an issue. How can that be? How is it that in a new media context, the relationship to publicity, to being online, to being seen, are no longer accompanied by the same kind of anxiety?
It reminds me of the pitch that the New York Police Department sort of responded to Bob Herbert's piece, in which they said, fundamentally, no, this is good, because if we have a picture of you at, you know, Toity, Toit, and Toit today, and you're charged with, you know, something naughty in Brooklyn at the same time, we can establish that you were here, which is
hilariously absurd.
Yeah.
It's like it bespeaks of a kind of spectacular media illiteracy. And in a certain sense, you could describe that all of my work as attempting to contribute to a kind of what we might call surveillance literacy. This is not an anti-surveillance position. This is a position that says you need to be deeply aware of what and how you're leaving traces, what kind of information can and shouldn't be captured about you, and take a responsible position. Most people, for example, are not aware of the phenomenon of data shadow. Everyone in this room has a data shadow. Data shadows are what is created through the aggregation of databases, your EasyPass, telephone records, credit cards, frequent flyer, et cetera, et cetera. And these are basically profiles of you that are marketed and sold. But of course, the interesting thing about data in an age of the digital is that despite the fact that all of us have lost data, contrary to that experience, in fact, data is actually very hard to get rid of. Data survives a long time. So when, through choice or mostly through non-reflection, you give up your data to somebody, what you're basically saying is not only I trust the current state of affairs, what are they going to do with my data? They're not really, this is not a fascist Orwellian Big Brother government. One could argue about that, but let's leave that conspiracy theoretical discussion for another time. But what's more important is to realize that what you're doing when you're giving up your data is you're saying, I trust every possible future government, every possible future political configuration, because your data never comes back. To get rid of your data, to get rid of such traces is virtually impossible.
There was a moment maybe 10 years ago when I had my first sort of grocery store credit card in which, you know, I suddenly realized not me, but everybody, including me, could be, I mean, they know what we eat. They know, for example, applying for insurance. Do you eat processed food? Do you eat too much fat? Do you buy too much liquor? Who cares? And how might it be used? But
in the context of, you know, medical record surveillance, and particularly in the context of the current debates about health insurance, you know,
yeah, it bears.
Health insurance does care. And, you know, when your diet becomes a matter of public record, there may be issues.
You say you're not ideological, Tom, but spell out the outline of how to think about a responsible position on surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Look, I fly a lot. I love the fact that when I check in, the airline knows that I like this kind of seat, that I like this kind of meal, et cetera, et cetera. I'm willing to give them that kind of information because there's a trade-off. That's a choice I've made. I'm not willing to give other kinds of information. So, for example, when I go into a store to buy a totally banal object, Radio Shack, the Tandy Corporation of Texas, was a pioneer in this already in the 70s. When I go in to buy batteries and they ask, oh, can we have your phone number? Your attitude should be, hell no! You don't need my phone number for me to buy batteries. Even if you're paying cash, you don't give up your data gratuitously, right? There's sometimes when you give up your data because there's a reason to, and there are other times when, and in such cases, you ought to make a kind of pedagogical spectacle of your refusal.
What about all these invitations to give your email when obviously it's just so that they can badger you down the road?
Look, they're very easy techniques for tactical introduction of noise into the system. You give a phony email, right? There are sometimes when they just need an identifier, and you should have a regularly used fictitious email that you give to introduce a certain kind of disturbance. Noise can be helpful.
James Dedarian.
Yeah, I want to carry on this subversive line, Tom, push you a little bit further, see if we can get into real trouble with the FCC and the rest of the surveillance organizations. And this theme of keep your hands off my data. Too late. It's much too late. I'm just wondering if this move from Big Brother, which was always a sort of an idea of totalitarianism, you know, top-down surveillance. Now the surveillance has a ubiquity to it, but also, as Chris identified, it has no resistance.
And no, it's embraced enthusiastically.
Yeah.
Surveil me, please, Facebook.
And that's exactly where I want to go with this.
Absolutely.
Is it that, you know, what Foucault said about, you know, every new form of power produces resistance? Is it possible because this power is so invisible that it's difficult to produce resistance? So, A, the first part of the question is, right. What accounts for this transition? Is it more just sort of an exhibitionist, voyeuristic, psychological you know, matrix? Or is there something else in classical ways that power once had a cause and effect that we can't really identify anymore? And how do we counter it?
Yeah, it's a super important and tricky question, which we can only begin to sketch some of the aspects of here. Look, with every new media come interesting possibilities and interesting threats and dangers. At the moment of the introduction of new media, the question is, who profits from a general illiteracy about certain capacities of these new media? In this case, the fact that most people didn't realize when they started using social media of various sorts that what they were giving up when they were broadcasting themselves was a kind of right to all the data that they were making available to, they thought, just their friends. Now, whether we need a logic of power or Orwellian Big Brother to account for that, what's clear is that there are interests that have profited from that technical illiteracy. And thus, my position is the way to respond is not to demonize the technology. This is not a kind of Baudrillardian whining about, oh, there used to be the real, it is no longer. There used to be subjectivity and agency, and now we have no more. Rather, it's a call for, and it's a rather traditional call, for a kind of responsibility. It's an enlightenment project. It says, learn privacy settings, know how to use your technology, become technically literate. We no longer have the luxury to use technology that we simply don't understand. It's the urgency of what one could call technological literacy, media literacy. It's something that Walter Benjamin called for in the 30s. He says, you know, when a photograph, maybe it is now in the age of photography, the people who can't read a photograph that are the new illiterates, he writes in his Short History of Photography. What would it mean to think through a notion of new media literacy? What is such a literacy? What would it involve? And above all, what is involved in teaching it, right? How is it possible that a university like Princeton, where I teach, doesn't have a program in media like MCM here at Brown? It would seem to me that one of the central responsibilities of an undergraduate institution is to teach people, undergraduates the critical, interrogatory, analytic tools to understand the media that are so deeply shaping their lives.
We've mentioned the second thoughts about Facebook, which never quite catch up with the Facebook's remaking of itself. That question is out there everywhere now. Is Google making us stupid? All part of a sudden skepticism, but still rising, about the internet. Daniel Gelertner, Jaron Lanier, Jonathan Zittrain, all asking fundamental questions about what we're into already. Is it digital Maoism? Is it an anthill where we used to have human beings? What has happened to authorship, ownership, responsibility for an idea, individuality? I'm not at all sure I buy it. I'm not at all sure I buy the critique, but I'm intrigued by this notion that the internet means herds and beehives, and not to mention the destructive power that we are seeing unleashed on traditional giants of media like the television networks, the great newspapers, and all that sort of thing. I want the Tom Levine general take on this internet age that we're only well begun in, but suddenly a certain buyer's remorse.
Look, I think at some level, part of this is a kind of corrective to an equally uncritical techno-libertarian, gaga enthusiasm that marked the beginning of cyberspace, where everybody said, you know, in cyberspace, nobody knows if you're a dog. It erases class and gender, and isn't this marvelous? And micro communities, and we can be whoever we want, and what a utopian thing that's going to save the world, right? Now, much of that is true. There are remarkably interesting capacities that these new media afford us, but perhaps not just in ways that are utopian. We're now beginning to see the shall we say, nasty underbelly that comes with the struggles for of defining a new media. Now, the question you raise about the agonistic relation between new media and older media, that's a story that a media historian knows all too well, has repeated itself throughout the course of history, right? Television and cinema, right? With the advent of television, cinema goes through unbelievable agony about, oh, is this going to displace the cinematic? In fact, if you go back a few more decades, the end of the 19th century with the advent of cinema, guess what? Huge hand-wringing about cinema means the end of theater, the end of literature, the end of civilization, the vulgarization of culture. And yet at the same time, techno-utopian discourses around, here, finally, literacy, that is, the ability, for example, to write letters, is suddenly available to everyone, and not only people who can actually write, which is to say women and other classes that were excluded from the luxury of literacy. Here, anybody who can see can understand a film, or with the gramophone, anybody who can speak. Remember, the gramophone initially was also a read-write technology. You could speak into the gramophone and record and then send your voice, et cetera, et cetera. Suddenly, it opened up letter writing to an entirely new community. So this struggle between the utopian and its, shall we say, dystopian underbelly is one that has accompanied the history of the advent of new media for, shall we say, a long time.
Every one of these things has a sort of double edge. I'm thinking of the protesters who were arrested at the George Bush renomination convention in New York in 2004. Well, it turned out they had their own surveillance media. They were photographing the cops and they hadn't done anything, and they were basically let off the hook by their own use of media. But in every case, there's a huge war going on between this internet technology that empowers individuals, gives every blogger a voice, etc. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we're into an age of propaganda too, and concentration of all of these powers in mysterious ways. I don't know. Tell us, how does it come out?
Ah, yes. I won't tell you how it comes out because I don't think anybody would be that arrogant to know. But I can tell you that you certainly pointed to a really important dimension of what one could call the use of tactical media, that is, new media as politically empowering technology that allows for example, we learned this as early as the Rodney King video, when an involuntary amateur on a balcony testing out his new camera captures the violent police beating of Rodney King. Interestingly enough, as the trial of Rodney King, just having a video of a seemingly self-evident political violence is not enough, right? So too, we know that the use of media to document abuses of various sort is at once an empowering possibility. Think of the marvelous example of a kind of YouTube for human rights. I'm thinking of The Hub, which is the video or web component of this group that Peter Gabriel helped found called Witness, which gives cameras and other new media literacy tools to people, you know, people engaged in various kinds of political struggles, right? When you give these kinds of tools to people who don't have a voice, that affords them access to a platform that can be transformative.
James.
Let's get the students involved here. Who's got a question or a comment? And let's get it on the mic. We need self-identification to put into our database.
Hi, my name is Jeff Tratner. If you search for me on Google, I'm the only result. So there you go. So actually, I was just going to comment on something along those lines. You describe new media, one of the biggest problems is being a problem of data. So you go to the grocery store and they know what you eat. You go to Facebook, you post stuff like there. But I'm wondering, maybe the problem is instead the revelation. Like, oh my goodness, this person, you know, only eats fats. This person, you know, posted about his furry problem on Facebook and now, you know, it's everywhere. So do you think that maybe the problem isn't privacy as you're putting it out, but rather that we are surprised that we don't have privacy?
You know, it's certainly true that people today don't have the assumption of privacy. It's not even clear that privacy is indeed something we necessarily value. It's not clear to me, however, what the best strategy to produce a kind of sense of responsibility. I think that may be perhaps the most useful term for one's activities online. Let me give you an example. When you go online to a certain site, the computer database of that site can know what IP number has contacted that site, that is your computer, but it can't know who's on the computer. Well, but it turns out that when you type, you have a particular cadence that, in fact, is pretty reliably regular, such that you can identify who's on the computer by analyzing keystroke cadences. So that this would allow us to say not only your computer contacted this kiddie porn site, but in fact, this was the person who was on your computer when that site was accessed. Now, you know, this is the avant-garde of, shall we say, identification. Happily, however, most of these technologies, like missile defense systems, which are so highly vaunted, don't work, right? Facial recognition doesn't work. Iris recognition doesn't work. There's this really interesting problem that menstruating women's irises look differently. So that even the iris, which seems like such a reliable biometric, is not. In fact, the lesson that the East German secret police learned, that is, the hard way, that too much data basically stifles the ability of an intelligence agency to do anything with it, is, despite the incredible capacities of data crunching that we have, still a problem today. There's basically too much data for it to be processed. And that, in a certain sense, is the saving moment, right? That literally, it's just not yet possible to do what the kind of NSA wet dream of total information awareness, to use that hilarious acronym, fantasized about. Could it be that at some point in the near future, when, thanks to Moore's law, certain data capacities are able to, you know, handle that level of data? Perhaps, but it's certainly not immediate. Think, for example, video surveillance. The sheer amount of video generated is too much for anybody to see. So the big issue in video surveillance is machine vision, teaching machines to watch for you. Super interesting set of questions raised there.
Tom, just quickly, total information awareness. I think you told me a story about the Stasi who, in order to track people, they were using dogs and...
Oh, the East German secret police had huge warehouses filled with jars, the kind of jars you use for conserving like marmalade, inside of which jars were pieces of cloth. Well, it turns out that when you went for an interview with the Stasi, after you left, they would take the fabric that was on the seat that you had just sat on and put it in a jar to create, I kid you not, an archive of crotch odors. And the thing looks like a Jeff Koons installation, these jars and jars and jars of crotch odors. But in fact, it was something they ostensibly used in a kind of bizarre, kind of surrealist fantasy for dogs to track you if you were to try to escape across the border or to identify people. But it's an example of a kind of hilarious pathology of identification.
Hi, I'm Samoura Atalla. I'd like to ask you to elaborate more on the interplay between global terrorism and surveillance and the way in which subjects might react to this technology. Do you think that at a certain point, if global terrorism significantly increased, maybe more people will endorse this technology because ultimately it will mean that there's a possibility of protection? So like, oh, yeah. On security versus liberty,
sure.
I guess.
Look, you've put your finger on the classic dynamic. Look at the case study, which is Great Britain, right? Why is it that in Great Britain there is an absolutely epidemic level of surveillance? Look back a little bit in history and you will see in the wake of the IRA terrorist bombings and the deep social anxiety that it produced, the those who had interest in producing this level of surveillance intervention immediately seized upon it and wildly increased to a level is simply unimaginable, but which we are rapidly approaching in the United States today, a kind of quotidianity, a daily life level of surveillance. That is the dynamic that we have witnessed again and again. A trauma leads to anxiety, and in the space created by that anxiety and in the fear, capitalizing on the fear created by that anxiety, introduction of surveillance is introduced, which is only contained by legislative constraints. So the question is really, who's constraining what can be done? And here I would like to point out something that one could call the politics of the default setting. Interestingly enough, exemplary in that regard is Germany. Germany's data politics at the legislative level are really fascinating. There you have the right to what is called informationelle Selbstbestimmung, informational self-determination. That is, you get to decide who gets to know what about you. Why might it be that Germany is so good about this? And believe me, there are forces in Germany, particularly after the revelation that some of the 9/11 terrorists were in the Harburg cell outside of Hamburg, that would love to dismantle this. But it's not by accident that this is in Germany. Why? Because Germany was a country in which embraced the Hollerith card system invented by Thomas Watson, as in Watson Institute. Indeed, Watson got a medal from Hitler. And it was only under pressure from the United States that he gave it back. Why? Because the Nazis loved using data processing system to sort homosexuals, Jews, gypsies, etc. Germany knows all too well the trauma of a legislatively unconstrained use of data in the political realm. Thus, the question is, in the context of a unbridled explosion of surveillance in the wake of such a trauma, what kind of legislative constraints are being introduced? And what kind of legislative constraints do we want, do we think are responsible? Is the default setting, you can know everything about me unless I tell you you can't, which is what's the case in the Wild West of the United States data landscape? Or should it be, as in Germany, you can't know anything unless I specifically let you know? That's an important question.
I wonder if there's a devil's advocate case to be made against privacy. There's something in us that wants to bust out of that sort of Victorian isolation, inhibition, extreme shyness. You can't see me naked or whatever. There's something that wants to know that we're not alone, that there are others like us out there. You know, Meetup was founded on the Timothy Leary notion, sort of find the others. Well, now we can find the others. Mm-hmm. And there's power in it. There's human discovery.
Look, there's no question, and this is the magic of cyberspace, the ability to discover micro communities of like-minded,
or even majority communities against the war in Iraq, for example.
Fine, there's no question that there are empowering dimensions to new technology. The perhaps extreme version of this idea, expounded a couple years ago by a guy named David Brin, who's basically said, the problem is not that we have too much surveillance, it's that we don't have enough surveillance. If everybody knew that everything that everybody was doing was always being watched by everyone, then people would behave. And this is the notion of a kind of transparency, responsibility produced by a kind of radical transparency. This, of course, is sweet as an idea, but hilariously naive, precisely because it doesn't, it fails to recognize the reality of the fact that access to such transparency is never, or the ability to produce such transparency is never total, and thus the question of what gets seen and what doesn't, what is, as it were, taking place in the unviewed pockets, is always what is most, or potentially most important.
Can I ask you the Nicholas Carr question? Is Google making us stupid in the sense of outsourcing our memory, outsourcing our research brain?
You know, I have to say I generally have an allergy towards kind of techno-dystopic whining. So I'll give you an example. You know, is Google changing the way we access data or things? Sure. Does that have consequences for the way we think, for the way our culture understands, values, memory, memorization, et cetera, et cetera? Sure. When I teach a class, and like here, there are tons of laptops open, and we mention something, and a name, a date, et cetera, and somebody quickly types it into a search engine and comes up with exactly the kind of information that we need that enriches the conversation, I would say, there, a search engine is making us smarter. It's helping the conversation. It's allowing for a range of inputs that afford greater, potentially greater insight. Now, I don't want to sound like a techno-utopianist either. This is, you know, as Fred Jameson said years ago, you know, every technology has a utopian dimension and a reification dimension, and we have to attend to both, right? Are there potentially, you know, worrisome consequences of access to everything, or it's not everything, access to huge amounts of a material at the click of a mouse? Potentially, but as anybody who's lived or worked in a remote place knows, having access to an incredible library, which is to say access to the archive, is at the same time an incredibly utopian thing. Huge amounts of materials are becoming available. Is it simply a sour note? No.
James.
As usual, Tom, you've exhausted my ability to ask another question. I think you've answered them all. I'm particularly glad that we've been able to find sort of a pleasurable state of paranoia out of the surveillance state.
I think that's a well put.
And I want to thank you for that. And I'm going to turn it over to Chris to wrap it up.
If there are no more student questions. Yeah. Tom Levine, thank you. We've covered a lot of ground. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, you guys.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.